Hey there, it's Joshua. Did you know 1A is possible because of you? Yes, you. When you give to your local NPR station before the year ends, you're building support for the NPR programs you have come to know, love, and depend on. Programs like 1A. And you're also supporting local journalism in your community. So don't wait. Donate. Do your part in sharing the conversation and supporting the public radio system with a year-end gift to your local NPR station. Just visit donate.npr.org/1A to give. And thanks. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. What makes a great pop song? Is it the way it makes you want to dance? Or maybe how it gets stuck in your head? It's a worthwhile question to ask at the end of 2019 with genre-bending hits like Billie Eilish's Bad Guy or Lil Nas X's Old Town Road.
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached. Head is matted black. Got the boosters black to match. Riding on a horse. Ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley. You ain't been up off that porch. Now, can't nobody tell me nothing.
Pop music is much more than just commercial fluff designed for mass consumption. I mean, it is, some of it is that. But its influences go back centuries, and its influence on our culture might surprise you, from fashion to law to politics. To talk about all this and more, we're joined by the hosts of Switched on Pop, a podcast from Vox that deconstructs pop music to explain its success and its place in our culture. Charlie Harding is the podcast's executive producer. Charlie, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
And Nate Sloan is the co-host. He's also a professor of musicology at the University of Southern California. Professor Sloan, welcome.
Great to be here.
I think we should begin by defining what we mean by pop music. I tend to think that it has a little bit to do with its earworminess, with its ability to just kind of get stuck in your head and stay there whether you want to cape it or not. But Nate, Charlie, how do you define what a pop song is? Nate, let me start with you.
Yeah, of course. I think you have to approach it from a few angles. I think one way to determine popular music is, it's right there in the title. It's simply what is popular. Look at what most people are listening to in the world at any given point, and that will tell you what is pop. And then at the same time, pop is also a sound. It's a style. It's a certain set of musical characteristics. But those change over time. Pop will always reflect the moment in which it's produced. So I think you have to kind of look at it from a musical perspective and then a metric of what are the most people listening to at one time.
Now, Nate, when we say most people, what people are we referring to?
Right. Well, we go by the same metric that a lot of people use, which are the Billboard charts, which are not the be-all end-all of how to measure people's listening habits, but they're pretty good. They take into account what people are streaming, what they're listening to on the radio, and what they're buying from stores and online.
Professor Harding, what about you? How do you define pop music?
There are things that can be popular music that might not be on the Billboard that could be in the pop zeitgeist more broadly. So there are songs that sort of might exist on social media before they ever break into the Billboard. You know, in fact, when Old Town Road, before it had made it on the Billboard, when radio DJs wanted to play it, they actually had to go pull it off of YouTube because there wasn't a file that could grab anywhere, and it was already bubbling up in the popular zeitgeist. So it doesn't have to be in the charts. It can be something which is just out there and is bubbling up.
Let me stick with you, Charlie. How did this podcast come about? I imagine that there's something a little bit risky about intellectualizing something that people just kind of react to on an emotional entertainment level that can suck the fun out of it if you're not careful.
Totally. I mean, we like to think that listening more deeply actually makes the experience of listening to popular music even more exciting and more fun. The show came about when Nate and I were driving down the Route 1 in California. We had been relegated to the back seat by our partners because they could not really put up with our musical conversation. And Nate had just finished teaching a course in which the song Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen came up. And I'll have to admit, at that point in my life, I think I was a bit more of a little bit of a music snob, if you will. And I'm not proud of that. But I was like, Call Me Maybe, that's just, you know, pop bubblegum commercial fluff. Why does that matter?
I'm sorry, hold on. Pause that story for just 1 second. For those who have not heard the song, let me play a quick clip of it, and then I'll let you finish your story. Here's a little bit of Carly Rae Jepsen's hit, Call Me Maybe. That's Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen. Okay, sorry to interrupt. Finish your story.
Nate really has the whole take and lecture on this. So, Nate, what did you tell me that totally turned the whole thing around?
So I was teaching, I was using this song in a class, a music theory class I was teaching to high schoolers, because I was kind of tired of using these obscure examples from the classical canon that none of them were familiar with to teach concepts of harmony, rhythm, etc. I thought, why don't we take a pop song that people know and it's in their ears, and then we can use that as our example. And then this kind of funny thing happened where I guess I was using the song as a means to an end, but after analyzing it, the song became an end in itself. And I was sharing Charlie some of the insights from our breakdown of the song, and we were both just kind of marveling at how much more compositional craft went into even the most kind of anodyne of pop songs than we had anticipated. And that song really sent us on this journey of trying to confront our own biases about pop and trying to learn more about how pop music works.
Is it necessary, Charlie, to confront your own biases about pop music, or can you just say, oh, I like this, I hate this?
No, it's totally okay to have your own taste. Say, I like this, and that thing's not for me. But oftentimes the things that might not sound good to you, that you might even start to call bad music, are never objectively bad. They're serving somebody. They're serving some public. They're operating on some sort of level and providing meaning, catharsis, whatever it might be, to a particular community. And oftentimes the things that we're most turned off to are the things where we have the most potential to learn. And Nate and I really believe that one of the best ways to approach things that we don't know is to develop a little bit more musical language. And so that's what we try to establish on our show and in our book, is give people the building blocks of what you need to know about music, not to overly intellectualize it, but to be able to listen to it and enjoy it on another level.
So let's go back to Call Me Maybe. What do we learn, Charlie, from Call Me Maybe? What did you glean from that?
Okay, yeah. So Call Me Maybe is such a fascinating track. And, you know, she says, before you came into my life, I missed you so bad. There's these sort of like almost sort of nonsense lyrics that don't quite add up. And what Nate helped me realize, that this song is really about that sort of ambiguous state in a relationship where we might fumble our words and make awkward statements, just as she does in the lyrics, but the music actually supports that message. So just for example, when she breaks into the main line of the song, into the chorus, before she says any word, she actually pauses. There's this little pause moment. So she's hesitating, yeah, as if she's sort of frightened to say the thing that she has to say to her lover.
It's like, pause. Hey, there's this little moment of anticipation or nervousness, and then she gets out that first line. Sorry, please continue.
Yeah, and then simultaneously, you know, every song is usually within a key, a chord center. Mm. Usually people might know like the key of C. And this song happens to be in the key of G. And what's interesting is, you know, usually that home space, that key of G, when you land on it, you really feel a sense of like, I know where I am, I'm comfortable, everything's good. But what's happening in this song is that key of G, that chord, that home chord, is actually cycling in sort of off beats and places where it doesn't quite belong, and you never get that resolution that you need.
Let me bring that up so we can kind of hear what you're talking about.
In my way, your stare was holding, ripped jeans, skin was showing, hot night wind was blowing. Where you think you're going, baby? Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe. It's hard to look right.
So it's that kind of tentativeness, that hesitation that reflects that experience of kind of being in that awkward, infatuated space. Is that what you're saying?
That is exactly what's going on.
Do you think maybe you're giving Carly Rae Jepsen a little too much credit?
You're
infusing a lot of poetry into a piece of music that might just be a simple piece of pop.
Yes. Well, I think it certainly is a simple piece of pop, but I think there's a lot of craft that goes into engineering, that simplicity. Now, at the same time, I think what you've just asked is a question that we're continually asking ourselves. You know, where is the axis of intention and accident that, or sort of just unconsciousness that goes into these pop songs? And we don't always know the answer. You know, some of these songs are written like in the course of a few hours in a songwriting session. But nevertheless, once they're out in the world, you can still sort of turn them over and figure out, okay, why did this song, out of all the songs that are constantly being put out there, like, why did this one make it to the top? What are some of the musical elements here that keep us hooked and keep us listening?
Alicia from North Carolina writes, whatever formula the people who make K-pop have, Korean pop music, has got to be near perfect. I don't speak the language, and I still listen to it. We'll get a little bit more musical language to describe pop music when we continue our conversation with Charlie Harding and Nate Sloan, the co-hosts of the podcast Switched on Pop. We'll take a look at where pop went this year and why sometimes pop does not need to follow a formula to be a hit. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you are listening along to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Who dropped the most memorable album or song in 2019? Was it Lil Nas X, Lizzo, Billie Eilish, or maybe someone you've never heard of? I'm Robin Hilton. Join NPR Music as we look back at the defining trends and artists of 2019. Listen on All Songs Considered with new episodes each week.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing what makes pop music pop with Nate Sloan and Charlie Harding, the co-host of the podcast Switched on Pop. One listener says that their perfect pop song is ABC by the Jackson 5. The listener writes, it has simple lyrics, it's catchy with an upbeat tune, and anyone can sing along. A quintessential earworm. Nate, what about that? I mean, this genre that we call pop music does trace back to the Jacksons and Elvis Presley and the Beatles, Aretha Franklin, many others. How do you account for the shifts in this genre decade by decade, sometimes within a decade?
Yeah, I mean, pop music is one of the fun things about studying it and listening to it closely is that it reflects so much about the moment in which it was made. And as you listen closely to the sounds of pop music, you can hear so many trends. In Elvis, you hear the appearance of new technologies like the electric guitar and vocal slapback delay effects. And as you move forward into the age of the Jackson 5, for instance, you start to hear maybe a reflection of a certain moment in the 70s when people were combining new styles like disco and funk and pop together into these Motown hybrid styles. I mean, whenever you listen to a pop song, it exists on its own in this sort of, you know, universe of platonic perfection, like we've been discussing. But it's also very much of its time. And what something that we've tried to do on our show is think about how does the music that makes it to the top of the charts, what does it say about the moment that we're living in?
Now, there's a lot of music that we want to go through in this conversation. We'll get to it in just a minute. But with regards to what you just said, Nate, is a pop song once? Can it be a pop song multiple times? I'm looking at the Billboard Hot 100 right now, and because of the time of year that this is, Bobby Helms' Jingle Bell Rock is number 23 yeah. on the Billboard Hot 100. Andy Williams' It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year is 24. Dean Martin, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow is 28. And I don't know, the Christmas song by Nat King Cole is 33rd on the Billboard Hot 100. I don't know a whole lot of people who are trying to imitate, you know, Nat King Cole these days, or, you know, that old Dean Martin. Oh, the weather outside is cool. That's just not a pop sound.
Dean? Is that you, Dean?
That's, well, you know, listen, Pally, I'm trying to get my question answered here.
But is it pop once or is it pop every time it's on the chart?
Yeah, I don't know. Wow, that's a great, that's a wonderful philosophical question. I would say it's pop. You know, at the top of the show, Charlie defined pop as not just what's popular by the metric of, you know, what's on the top of the Billboard charts, but also popular what's surging into our collective conscience. And in that respect, Christmas music going back to the 1940s, I would say, is absolutely pop music. And you go back even further. I wonder if you could even say every time people sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game at the seventh inning stretch of a baseball game, they're singing a 1908 pop song. And I would say that's absolutely pop music. It doesn't. To answer your question, I don't know. I would say as long as it's still part of our world and our collective conscious, then why not? It's absolutely pop.
Charlie, I want to look back at some of the standout hits of the year from the Billboard charts. And according to the year-end chart, Billie Eilish had the biggest album of the year. Here is a little bit of Billie Eilish's hit song, Bad Guy. Just can't get enough, guy. Just always so puff, guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. Duh. That's Bad Guy by Billie Eilish. And Charlie, an NPR article that came out just today actually says Billie Eilish is the class of 2019's weird achiever. Is that part of what makes her so popular, is just her oddity?
Sure. You know, in pop music, absolutely, image does matter. You know, for a lot of people, the first connection to Billie Eilish may be through social media or through her music videos. But you know, you opened with, hey, this is the number one album of the year. And I think musically, it's absolutely deserved, because this is a tour de force of pop songwriting. It hits you in so many different ways, and it is odd. It defies the rules just as much as it contains them.
I wonder if also part of it is just the hook of the song. Let's play back the chorus of Bad Guy one more time. Listen through.
Duh.
So someone like me hears that and they hear just that beat, and I wonder, like, what is that song? And then I pull out my phone and I Shazam it, because I keep hearing that doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo thing over and over. I'm like, what the hell is that? And I Shazam it. I'm like, oh, Billie Eilish, never heard of her. And then I start playing it. Something about the hook gets me into the song, which gets me into the artist.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has a great hook. I mean, and as I was saying earlier, this song actually does defy convention a little bit, because it actually doesn't really have a chorus. In fact, I think that sort of is emphasizing the sort of bad guy message. She has this beautiful sort of pre-chorus section, right? And then it gets to, I'm a bad guy. And then you get this beautiful little synth hook. And that synth hook is almost like what's happening there. It's almost like a drop from EDM music rather than acting as a vocal chorus that you can sing along to.
EDM, electronic dance music?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So she's sort of borrowing the language from what's happening on a dance floor, where there's an instrumental section rather than a chorus. And what's getting stuck in your ear is just that little synthesizer.
By the way, I should note that right now, Bad Guy by Billie Eilish is number 21 on the Billboard Hot 100. It has been at number one, and it's been on the charts for 36 weeks. Last week, it was at number 14 on the Billboard Hot 100, so it's kind of making its way up and down the charts. Glad to hear some of your other suggestions for your favorite pop classics. One listener writes, Sugar Sugar by the Archies defines pop. Bum, 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 bum. It gets stuck in my head whenever I have or need a sweet moment. It was manufactured by brilliant songwriters long before I was born, and 50 years later conveys every good feeling they intended. Nate, I'd like you to react to that, particularly that one word, manufactured. I'm not sure how to take that word.
Yeah, manufactured, I don't think it's an inaccurate description. I mean, there is certainly a sort of assembly line approach to pop composition, But I think whether we view that as inherently negative might depend on our perspective. The author John Seabrook talks about popular music today being kind of like Michelangelo's studio, in the sense that today we talk about the Renaissance painter Michelangelo as the singular entity as who painted the Sistine Chapel by himself. But in reality, he was the head of a whole workshop, a team of artisans who created these compositions together. That might be a helpful way of thinking about modern pop songwriting, which is also inherently collaborative, has a lot of cooks in the kitchen, focused on making something with a lot of mass appeal. I think that's all true. I don't think it necessarily means that the products themselves are somehow substandard. I just think it's a different mode of production.
Let's talk about Lizzo for a minute. She's another artist who took the year by storm, one of my favorite new artists. Some of y'all saw her performance on the MTV Video Music Awards, where she just turned it all the way out. Her album is called 'Cause I Love You. Here is a bit of the title track.
I would do it for you all, my friend. Ready, baby? Will you be my man? Wanna put you on a plane, fly you out to wherever I am. Kept you on the low, I was ashamed.
That's 'Cause I Love You by Lizzo. Nate, I love Lizzo, but her sound is an almost perfect throwback, with the exception of just the rap in it. This could have been something from, you know, from Aretha.
Yeah. And that was, you know, we actually spoke to the co-writer of this song, Sam Harris, on our program. And it's funny you mention Aretha, because he listed that as one of the exact references that they were throwing around in the studio when they were putting the song together. So good on you, Joshua. Good ears. Yeah, I totally agree. I think one of the things we love about this song is the way it combines old and new. You have this kind of classic soul sound with the 6/8 rhythm and these horns all over the place. And yet there are also these very contemporary elements. There's the breaking into rap, like you said. And there's also another subtle reference to modern music in the drums. The hi-hat rhythms here are drawn from the genre of trap music, one of the modern styles of hip-hop. And one of the things that makes that really characteristic are these fast, rattling hi-hats that go tick, 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 tick. I mean, that's my best. That's my best version of that.
B plus.
Thank you. I'll take it. So what's so cool about this song is that it takes this classic 60s Aretha vibe and puts it on top of these rattling contemporary trap drums. I think that's what makes this song so masterful.
Well, and also, you know, Charlie, there's some pieces of this that feel like they cross intergenerationally. I mean, there's the blues sound of it, but a lot of the musical construction, the 6/8 time, even some of the chord structure, comes right out of gospel music. Even the kind of the doom, 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 doom. That's gospel. Yeah. Like, I remember growing up with that in church. So some of these just feel like they're cultural, and then they're cut into genres later, and because they cut across so much, Charlie, they lock in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Lizzo is really particularly a master of exactly what you're speaking about, which is that she's going to take whatever message she's trying to articulate, and she's going to find the genre that best makes that come alive. And so when we were talking with Sam Harris, the co-writer, he told us that this actually came about as a concept first, in which Lizzo had been in the car with her ex-boyfriend and she was crying, and he says, "Why are you crying?" And she says, "I'm crying because I love you." And she said that line to him, telling him the story, and he says, "That's a song, and that's an Aretha song." She said, "Yeah," and she starts singing a line, and it all just sort of comes together, and that the message was, how do we communicate, "I'm crying because I love you," and grabbing those elements of soul and gospel, but putting them in a contemporary mode is really Lizzo's genius, because you go to the next song on her album, the song after that, and it's a different genre every song that meets the message of what she's trying to communicate. And it's usually about some kind of female empowerment. It's bold. It's beautiful. It's just absolutely wonderful. We love
Lizzo. We're fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not clear.
Because I Love You is very different from Truth Hurts, which is different from Good as Hell, and they kind of lock together to make this character that is Lizzo. We'll get back to our conversation in a minute. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are the perfect gift for the woman in your life who is always on the go and loves a good balance of fashion and function. Rothy's are carefully crafted shoes made from repurposed plastic water bottles. They're stylish, available in a wide array of colors and patterns, and fully machine washable. Best of all, they're comfortable and have zero break-in period. Plus, enjoy free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges. Check out their seasonal styles at rothys.com/1A.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Don't forget to do your part and donate to your local NPR station before the end of the year. And guess what? Supporting public radio just got easier with Text to Give. To get started with your donation to an NPR member station, visit donate.npr.org/1A. Or just text the word give to the number 49648. We'll send you a text message with a link where you can find your local station and make your contribution. Message and data rates may apply. You can visit npr.org/smsterms for privacy and text message terms. So, don't wait. Donate. Do your part in sharing the conversation and supporting the public radio system. Thanks. Back now to our conversation with Charlie Harding and Nate Sloan, the hosts of the podcast Switched on Pop. You also, in your book, Switched on Pop, feature some of the biggest pop hits of the 21st century. One of the songs is a piece that was really super-duper controversial from an artist who has been very, very controversial over the course of her career. But you can't deny the fact, whatever you think of this song, it's a bona fide hit. Everybody, oops, I did it again. Come on, guys.
I played with your heart.
There you go.
Got lost in.
Go ahead.
Oh, baby, oops.
Oh, we got to get you on the beat. Never mind. Just turn it down.
Sorry. Are we still live? I got completely carried away.
That was Britney Spears with Oops, I Did It Again. We will rehearse this again next time, damn it. We will get this right. What does this song teach us, Nate, about pop music?
There's so much in here. We could talk about vocal timbre, Britney Spears, how she sort of alternates between sort of naive wonder in the chorus and knowing sophistication in the verse. We could talk about the chord progression here, which is actually called La Folia. It goes all the way back to the 1500s. Composers like Georg Friedrich Handel have used this chord progression. But I think one of my favorite things about this track is something that the music theorist Megan Lavingood points out. At the very end of this song, you get a collision of two different choruses. So sometimes in the song, Spears sings what we were just doing. Oops, I did it again. But then at one point she sings this other version of the chorus where the melody is slightly different and it has a pause. It's like, oops, I did it again. And so at the very end of the song, they slam those two choruses together and you hear like two versions of the chorus sounding at once in this contrapuntal mashup that is just so epic and exciting.
And by the way, before we move on, just for that term contrapuntal, you're talking about two different sounds that are played in counterpoint with one another that lock together in a unique way, right?
Right, it's a difficult thing in music because you have to write two melodies that will sound good on their own and then also work together when they're played simultaneously. Right. So going back to the age of Bach, it's been like a great sort of technical challenge for composers to write counterpoint.
Karen in St. Louis emailed, "Most pop, even if it's about a breakup, does something that connects us to it in a way that feels personal. Even if the song is sad, it makes us feel good. That's pop." Karen, I think your comment definitely applies to a pop hit that definitely took the charts by storm, one of the biggest hits by OutKast. That's Hey Ya by OutKast. Nate, why is this song significant? You write in the book that it contains decades of rhythmic progress. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually the opening chapter of our book because we think this song is so iconic. And it's especially the way it deals with one of the fundamental properties of music, beat, rhythm. This song is a great example of how there might be more than meets the ear with pop songs. I mean, this is a song that always gets people on the dance floor. According to Spotify, it's one of the top 10 wedding songs of all time. And yet, if you listen closely to the lyrics, it is not a very happy song. Actually, it's kind of a pessimistic song about how no relationship can really last. And yet, we don't seem to recognize that. We just seem to want to get on the dance floor and shake our booties. And Andre Benjamin kind of predicted that in the lyrics of the song. He says, "Y'all don't want to hear me. Y'all just want to dance." So the song kind of reflects that in its rhythmic structure. It doesn't use one of the standard meters, and meter is a term that refers to how many pulses are grouped together in the song.
Right.
So in this song, it starts with a four-beat pulse or four-beat meter. You can hear that in the very beginning. Andre 3000 counts off the song. He goes, one, two, three, And so he sort of establishes that four-beat meter right there. Mm-hmm. But then every time the song comes around, there's one section where he strips two beats from that four-beat meter.
Right.
So essentially
right.
It goes one, two, three, four, one, two, one, two, three, four. And when you're listening, you might not even notice that there's this moment where the pulse kind of like shifts from four to two. But maybe you feel that unconsciously, and it kind of reflects the discordant message of the song that even though the song is catchy, there's something under the surface that's not quite right.
One more song we definitely have to get to before our time is up, because it is Christmas time, holiday time. There's one particular song that seems to have constantly come up since 1994, and you know which one I'm talking about. It is that perennial hit by Mariah Carey. All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey. I wanted to make sure that we made room for this one, Nate, because yeah. Christmas music is definitely pop music in a way.
Oh, yeah. This is like a textbook pop song. In fact, this is one of the 15 best-selling singles of all time. And not only that, out of all those, it's the only one that is getting more popular over time. So this song was composed in 1994, and it's still gaining in popularity. It's wild. I think there's so much going on in this song. But you could talk about the form of the song, which is like this kind of old-school form. It's called AABA form. It's the same form used in like a song like Winter Wonderland or Let It Snow. So it kind of has this nostalgic feel to it. And then you also have Mariah Carey's virtuosic vocals. I think you can hear this really beautifully at the end of the intro to the song, where there's this pause, and then she kind of just launches into this incredible little vocal solo. All I want for Christmas. Okay, I went for it.
No, that was nicely done. I'm impressed.
Thank you. And then she goes, is you, and then the whole band comes in. That's like a technique straight out of opera. It's called Cadenza, and it kind of gives the, it's a pause that gives the singer a chance to showcase their voice. So from this old school Christmas form to like these operatic cadenzas, the song has so much going on that ensures every year it's going to be back, like playing everywhere.
One last quick question before we go, Charlie. Justin emailed, can the guests address the fact that a significant number of contemporary pop songs are written by a small handful of Swedish producers?
It is true that Sweden has very strong music education programs that have led to a very healthy ecosystem of producers.
Cough, cough, politicians, U.S. politicians.
Music education, very important. Yeah. And so there are studios that have been producing pop music from ABBA to contemporary music where there are, yeah, some of the biggest pop songs are written by Swedish songwriters, and many folks will fly out of L.A. to go to studios in Sweden.
Charlie Harding and Nate Sloan, co-host and executive producer of the podcast Switched on Pop, and also a professor of musicology at the University of Southern California. Guys, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you. It's been so fun.
This conversation was produced by Michelle Harvin and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.